Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I am your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. This week's episode features guest John Wood. We actually spoke at the end of January of this year, so I've been holding on to this interview for a bit because, you know, I've got quite a few in the bank and just working through them sequentially for the most part. And so now we're on to John Wood. He is the founder of Rage Heart, which is mostly a men's group kind of association dealing with processing men's emotions and energy, and also work with psychedelics and entheogens. And you can find out more about John and Rage Heart at www.rageheart.co, and we will get to our conversation very shortly. But first, of course, a few announcements. Thanks. Let's see. Who do I have to give thanks to today? I was actually gone for a little bit. Had a spring break trip to Sedona, Arizona, and there was a lot of weather, but it was also really awesome. It really is some of the best hiking in the world. If you want to see photographs, just go to my Facebook page at Martin W. Ball on Facebook, and there's a lot of photographs there, but we had a great time. Anyway, I was out, so just to kind of catch up with what's been going on while I was away, do want to thank Tom, who joined up at the God Molecule level over at my Patreon page and has become a top-tier supporter. Yay! Yay, Tom! And we're going to have our one-hour consultation coming up a little bit later this week. That's what you get at the God Molecule level once a month. We get a one-hour consultation or conversation or check-in or however you want to frame that for you. And of course, thanks to all of my ongoing supporters over at Patreon. You guys really are the primary supporters of this podcast, and your support every month over there really means a great deal, and I hope that you appreciate all that you get in return for that as well. Of course, this is a listener-supported podcast. That means I do rely on people like you out there listening to support the work that I do here. You know, this is an independent podcast, doesn't have any advertisers or anything like that. I'm also an independent publisher, independent author, independent musician. You know, I'm pretty independent. That's sort of the key word there. So I do rely on the support of the public, of people who appreciate and enjoy what I'm doing and what I'm putting out there to give a little support to that. So if you want to come on over to Patreon, you can stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net and use the link to Patreon at the top right of the page, or just go to patreon.com/martinwball and sign up at the level that is comfortable for you, everywhere from $1 a month to $100 a month, with increasing benefits and access all along the way, and gifts and bonuses and prizes and yada yada, all that cool stuff. Also, if you'd like to support me by making a contribution through PayPal, awesome. Stop by my personal webpage, martinball.net. Use the PayPal link at the top right of the page, and I will mention your name here in the podcast and say thank you. In another area that I'd like to issue a little thanks, I had two people, Robert and Iris, stop by my Bandcamp page, which is martinball.bandcamp.com, and they both picked up copies of my latest album, The Pure Energy of Unconditional Love. I hope you're enjoying the music, and thank you for your support. Music is an area where I don't make a lot of money. I got excited this past month that I got a $13 payment from CD Baby and then another $10 payment. And it's like, oh yeah, cool. I'm making it with music. And speaking of music, we can go move ahead to announcements. Of course, I am going to be speaking about the impact of music on an entheogenic experience, which will be at the Entheogenesis event that is being put on by the Church of Psilocybin in little under 2 weeks from now. That's going to be April 15th in Austin, Texas. You can check out more details at entheogenesis.io. There's a whole range of people who are going to be speaking and presenting and giving workshops, and I don't really have any details about how it's all going to be run. Just based on the number of people that they're having involved, I'm kind of imagining that it's going to be like pick who you're going to go see at any given time and which workshop you're going to go to or whatever, but you know, I don't know, but it's a one-day event, going to be there all weekend, really looking forward to that. Also, just want to mention that there's a new interview with me out there floating through the internet ethers. That was with Stephen Kirby at the Entheogenic Explorers podcast. He had me back on his show And I really think it's a great interview. We got into the entire history of the legality of psychedelic religion in the United States, talked about Supreme Court cases, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, what's going on with the development of new psychedelic churches in the United States and their legal status, and how do we define religion and who gets to do it and who decides. And I think it's a great podcast. It's kind of the lecture that I might give in a course on religious studies, which of course is what I have my PhD in. So I invite you to check that out. And it's also available at my Facebook page if you can't find it elsewhere. And lastly, but not leastly, I did want to mention that I got an email this morning from someone saying that his wife is creating a documentary and is looking for some public funding to help produce this documentary. And it's about the ancient healing traditions of Latvia. So this would be a Baltic country. And basically, these are the kind of women who, back in the Inquisition age, might have been deemed witches and burned as witches or heretics. So I got to see the trailer. It's over at Indiegogo.com. And I invite you to check it out. And if you feel like making a contribution, then go for it. It is at Indiegogo.com/Baltic-healing-documentary-film/. All right. So you can check that out. And if you want to support it, go ahead and do so. Fantastic. Okay. Well, I hope you have been enjoying selections from my medical memoir, A Sleep Story. We had a Mexican interlude last week. We're going to have another chapter coming next week. And of course, there are more great interviews coming your way. I've got lots of stuff lined up. I still have more already stashed away in the bank here, ready to send out to you. So there's lots happening here on the podcast. And who knows, maybe I'll interview some people when I go out to Texas for the entheogenesis and bring back some audio from that and share it here on the podcast. So, still celebrating 15 years old here at the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. Hope you've been enjoying as a listener. Let's get into the conversation with John Wood. And again, his website is rageheart.co. Here is our conversation from the very end of January earlier this year. So, welcoming onto the podcast today, John Wood, who is the founder of RageHeart.co, and I'll just read a little bit about what's on John's little bio here. It says, John Wood, a.k.a. the crazy Aussie who doesn't believe in meditation. Is that accurate?
What? It's a bit tongue-in-cheek. I've done a lot of meditation myself, but we can dive in and explore it if you like later.
Okay, good, good. Is the founder of RageHeart, an edgy new online school that teaches people how to navigate and integrate their psychedelic journeys without traditional tools like meditation, breathwork, or $49 moleskin journals. I like that. I always love humor in the psychedelic space. Maybe you've noticed this as well. A lot of people working in the psychedelic community, there's like an effluence of sincerity, and like everything's got to be sacred and serious and intense. And I really miss the levity in a lot of the psychedelic community. So I like what you're bringing in here, the $49 moleskin journals. It says Wood started the company when he noticed how many people struggle with psychedelics, whether it was staying calm during the experience or integrating the lessons afterward. Wood wanted to give people better tools because, according to him, the classic tools everyone recommends, and I'm right on you with this one, meditation, gratitude, journaling, and more, are disappointing at best and downright dangerous at worst. And yeah, this is something that I've talked about a lot here on my podcast, and also I work with clients for personal integration. And honestly, most of the stuff that's out there sold as integration is like so generic. It's just, it's worthless at worst. It's misleading also at worst. And so having really practical ways of integrating, I think, is important. And just generically telling people, meditate, have gratitude, write a journal is just, man, it makes me feel like banging my head against the wall. So John, I think we're going to have an interesting conversation today. But first of all, I've been kind of roundabout here, but welcome to the podcast. It's nice to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here, Martin. Thank you for having me.
And where are we connecting from today? Obviously, you're in Aussie, but are you down in Oz or where are you right now?
I'm in the Sacred Valley in Peru, just in a couple hours outside of Cusco.
Oh, okay. And is that your home base at this point? Or
It is now, yeah. So I was in Australia right up until, well, I've been here a year, 13 months now. So we left Australia for a few different reasons and was looking for a place with plant medicine and just amazing, an amazing community of people. And that's where we've ended up, basically. We've got some great people, plenty of plant medicine, you know, great house, just everything's great here. So I think we just picked up some kittens for Christmas. So we've got two kittens in the house now. We're dog sitting, you know. Yeah, it's a fantastic place. I wouldn't be surprised if I'm still here in 5 years.
Oh, great. And with all the sort of social, political upheaval that's happening in Peru right now, how is that impacting your experience in Peru?
Well, I don't really read the news aside from once every now and then I'll check it just to see what's happening. So I don't really know too much about, I'm not really up to date on what's really going on. I know it's to do with the president and the old president, new president. I know a bit about that, but as far as how it's affecting me, I mean, so I'm in the Sacred Valley. It's an hour and a half from Cusco. We're about 10 minutes sort of back. It's a very rural area, but 10 minutes back from the main road, Pista, I think they call it. And along there, it's all blocked right now. So there's, you got people coming in. I think they're mainly farmers coming in from like rural areas. They come in and they're basically putting giant rocks. When I say giant, like when I say like rocks, some of these rocks are, you know, things you could pick up by hand. Some of them are, I swear it would require like a bobcat. Like it's, you know, 3 feet tall and 3 feet round, you know, wide as well. You had a rock like that that someone somehow managed to get from who knows where, put it on the roads. They've got stuff like this. They've got tree stumps. So they block the roads for some reason. I don't really understand the purpose of it because it seems to make it hard for the locals who live here, not so much the government in Lima. But that's probably the only way it's affecting me personally. And I tried to go to the beach. Well, I went to the beach a few weeks ago. And so that was a little bit sketchy in the sense of one of the flights got canceled. And then there's the question of, can I get to the airport? Can I get home from the airport? But everything went down with no issues. So it really hasn't been, so far, it hasn't been a big deal at all. But I tend to stay out of all that stuff anyway.
So. Yeah. All right. Well, that's good to hear. So there's not like people marching down the street by your place or anything like that.
Not here. I mean, they raided the airport, a couple of the airports. Like, I think if I was in there running around with them, it'd be pretty dangerous. But yeah, we're all out of it. It's not really, it has nothing to do with foreigners. So as long as you don't need to get your groceries at a specific time on like Thursday at 2 p.m., it's like, you're not really going to have any issues. Some friends have gotten caught. They've gone into town and tried to come back and they get blocked up. They get blocked by the blockages and then have to hang out in the car for an hour or two. That's sort of the worst thing that I've heard happening to people I know here.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing. So, we'll start with where I like to start with people who are at least new on my podcast that I haven't gotten a chance to know or speak to before and also introduce the audience. So this is the point where I kind of invite you to tell a little bit about yourself. And of course, what we're always interested in is how did you get into working with psychedelic medicines? But just anything you want to share of your background and yourself so that we can get to know you a little bit would be great.
Well, from Sydney, from Australia, moved to Thailand, 2012. So went all over the place, but ended up in Thailand. When I was 18, 19, I was taking mushrooms and LSD. I was exploring, smoking a bit of weed here and there, but it was never done with intention. It was, let's get high, let's get fucked up kind of a thing. And then when I was in Thailand, I started dating this woman. She was very much into MDMA. So we started doing that. We'd get mushrooms, we'd get LSD, and we'd started to be gradually became more of a, I don't know if I'd say ceremonial, but we were like reading Eckhart Tolle and, you know, Power of Now, Michael Singer, the Surrender Dude. So getting into spirituality and then pairing it, the different things they would teach with psychedelics. And so it was, you know, it was very gradually started to become a way to, you know, work on ourselves or work through emotions, let things go, feel better. I'd go hiking in Thailand, actually. I had some friends. We're still there. I think we used to call it hikedelic. We'd go on a hikedelic or a free day where we'd, you know, drop, take some LSD and then just head up into the mountains in northern Thailand, near Chiang Mai, for just all day. You know, we'd take it at 7 a.m., just walk into the jungle. Have you been to Chiang Mai?
No, I've never been to Thailand or that part of the world.
Yeah, okay. So you got Thailand, northern Thailand, it's the foothills of the Himalayas. So you don't get any snow there, but decent sized mountain, lots of downhill mountain biking, trails everywhere. So we'd take our LSD and then just walk up. You can't really get lost because as long as you come down roughly in the direction of the city, all the trails lead back to the city. So we'd go up and get lost. We'd climb up creeks, do all kinds of silly stuff. And then once the sun seemed like it was almost gone, we'd walk down. So it was sort of, that was quite a therapeutic thing. And then with my girlfriend at the time, we, you know, was sort of exploring using different spiritual practices with it. And somewhere along the way, I think it was 2018, yeah, we listened to Alan Watts, and I think I found Ramana Maharshi, like the whole world of, you know, Vaitya and non-duality, which I know you're into. So started playing with some of those techniques. And I think one day, I think it was the first time it happened, was with LSD, and I was doing this being aware of being aware, and something clicked where the whole mind, I'm sure you know what I mean, everything just fell away. And it was like, oh, this is what all these dudes have been talking about. It was absolutely profound. It didn't last, as is pretty typical of these kinds of things, usually with psychedelics, but it definitely had an afterglow for a week or two, and it opened me up to something like, wow, there is something so incredible here in me, in these, you know, plants. And then, you know, something similar happened with mushrooms a couple of months after that. Drank ayahuasca in Australia. A little while after that, had probably the most intense experience I've ever had. Very beautiful, blissful, you know, everything just fell away. It's no me left, that kind of experience. And then since then, once I started to see the potential of what they were doing, and starting to realize that, oh, all these things I've been searching for outside me, thinking I need money or friends or success and lifestyle, and those things, you know, they're all important in different ways. But on a deeper level, everything I was really looking for was inside. And that's what I think started to happen with psychedelics. And, you know, once that had happened a few times, it's like, I have to take this further. I don't know where it's going. I still don't really. Like, I still love it. You know, I'm in Peru, so I'm working with plant medicine regularly. But, and I don't really know if it ends or where it really goes, but I just know I love it. I'm so passionate about it. It's changed my life. I've seen it change other people's lives. And yeah, that's kind of the Cliff Notes version, I guess.
All right. Well, I've got a new term to share with you that I got this just the other day. I was interviewing Ian Benwee's from the Church of Psilocybin, and he was talking about taking these new 5-MeO-DMT mushrooms and going on hikes. And the term that he shared with me that I really like, that really fits in the modern era. So you said, what was it, hikedelic? Was that the term?
Hikedelic, yeah.
Okay, so his term is hikrodosing. That's pretty good, isn't it?
I like that too. I'm going to share that with my buddies in Thailand. They'll love it.
Yeah, hyperdosing.
That's fantastic. I mean, those mushrooms sound fantastic too, to be honest. I've never done A5MEO. That's one thing that's, just haven't gotten around to it yet. So.
Yeah, well, now they've got these new mushrooms that they've figured out a process that you can feed the mushrooms 5-MeO-DMT before they turn into fruiting bodies. And then rather than producing psilocin and psilocybin, they produce 4-HO-5-MeO-DMT, so that it actually produces an edible form of 5-MeO-DMT. And there's no psilocin or psilocybin in the mushrooms. And so it's a edible 5-MeO-DMT experience.
That'd be... Because 5-MeO, as I understand, is very short and quick, just like smoking DMT. So is the 5-MeO mushrooms the same as that, or is it a different experience?
Oh, it's a different experience. It has about a 5-hour lifespan. But it's interesting that it has kind of a sharp incline, and then has a peak, and then has a fairly sharp decline. So, you know, usually psilocybin mushrooms take a little bit longer to come on. Or, you know, when you hit the peak and plateau, that you're kind of there for a longer period of time, and then it kind of a more gradual fading away. So it does feel a little bit more abrupt than traditional mushrooms, but it's far longer than vaporized or smoked 5-MeO-DMT. So the whole thing fits through in about 5 hours. It's really quite interesting.
That sounds fascinating. Oh man, I'd love to try that. It sounds a bit more digestible than 5-MeO, which is different.
Yeah, you know, I kind of say that it's comparable to ayahuasca is to smoked DMT as these psilocybin mushrooms are to smoked or vaporized 5-MeO-DMT.
You know, so, fantastic.
Yeah, so something for you to explore at some point, perhaps.
I'll put it on the list.
Yeah, so it sounds like your own entry into the world of psychedelics wasn't necessarily coming from a place of looking to heal trauma or... you know, resolve a health issue, but kind of more just on the exploration side and enjoyment, then kind of the deepening that happened and kind of more entry into these more rarefied states of consciousness and looking to see how you could develop that further.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Like, I haven't really thought about it that way, but yeah, what probably pulled me into the more healing therapeutic side was the spiritual stuff. Like seeing, yeah, these more ecstatic states, completely sublime, you can't describe them, all that. Like, that was what got me interested. But then over time, it's become, you know, realizing, okay, the reason I don't have access to that day to day is because of all the stuff that's hanging out in my system. So then the process since then has been coming more and more into embodiment and learning to feel emotions, learning to go through, you know, call it shadow work. I think about it more as trauma. So like energy that's stuck in the body, working at that level and learning to be here. Because I think for a while, I had an ayahuasca journey at one point where it was after I had some of these big, you know, spiritual breakthrough experiences kind of thing. And I felt like something, I guess it was ayahuasca, took me to the edge of the universe. And it was like I was trying to leave the universe, but then some part of me didn't really want to leave. And the lesson I took out of that was, you know, is trying to escape from life because there was pain, trauma, because there was things that weren't dealt with. And I was trying to run away from that into spirituality, the classic spiritual bypass. And, you know, since then it's been gradually realizing how, you know, disconnected I was in the past, much less so now from the body, so in my head, all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I went spiritual and then it's become much more sort of influenced by the whole world of trauma and the nervous system and healing and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's really the way to go. That's a big issue that I like to bring up and talk about is this question of embodiment and how do we embody the energies that we're experiencing during our psychedelic sessions? And then how do we integrate that? And how do we focus on what's happening in the body and the presence of being here and being present and being focused and aware, where I do think that a lot of the direction in psychedelics is about going out and people wanting to get astral and they want to ascend and they want to leave behind and, you know, have these transcendent experiences. And I'm always looking at how to direct people to bring that transcendent experience into your embodied presence right here and now. That for me, that's the absolute key of really what potential we have within the psychedelic experience. And like I like to say that you can go out as far as you want and you can keep going endlessly and you can keep trying to discover new things out there. So, but there's only one way to the center. There's only one way to actually being here, and that's to go into yourself, go into your heart, go into your body, and then be present. So I like to use that sort of as a visual metaphor. It's kind of what you're saying about this experience of being dropped off at the edge of the universe. Like, well, you can keep going, but what's the point? Where are you trying to get to? So it sounds like an important shift in your own understanding. So then when did you go about creating sort of this program of Rage Heart and focusing on these kinds of issues and helping people at that level?
As I was in Thailand, this is 2020, I'd started working with some coaches who offered a mushroom ceremony. So they were kind of like life coaches, but they mixed in plant medicine. They weren't proper shamans. They had an apprentice or anything, but just some coaches who were using mushrooms in how they worked with their clients. So I signed up with them, and they turned out to be basically very manipulative, narcissistic, abusive. We did a mushroom ceremony where they were meant to be obviously meant to be a healing thing. And I was a married couple, right? So what the dude's channeling and apparently channeling, talking to these aliens in another dimension, and comes out with this message, literally speaking in an alien language. And this, it's me and him and his wife. He's talking in an alien language, like he's on the phone with these things and trying to find out why John's not happy or fulfilled or doing what he wants to do with his life. And it comes out, according to him, John's killed 18 million people in his past life, or 20 million people. 18 million of them were innocent. So now he's got the karma of these 18 million deaths on him, which means 18 million locks on his power. He's too dangerous to unlock. There's a whole bunch of stuff. On top of that, outside of that space, the girl I was dating at the time, she was working with him too. Very horrible experience. It taught me a lot. It was lots of manipulation outside of that space. It was, you know, trying to make out that John's dark, John's, you know, he's evil. He's got all these dark impulses. Really, it's very cultish. I came out of that and actually read a bunch of books about cults and how they work and how they indoctrinate people into their system. it's a big part of it is breaking down someone's personality to that point where they don't trust in themselves. They think that something's wrong with them. They become a clean slate, and then you can install the cult program inside there, and they become kind of like a shell of their true self. And so that was, it was the early stages of that. I don't know where that girl I was dating, she's, as far as I know, still working with them. So this happened, and I was in Thailand at the time. And just about 3 months after that mushroom ceremony, I think it didn't sit right with me because it, you know, it was wrong what they did. But at first I did what most of us do, I think, at a certain time is, you know, I blame myself. I'm projecting. It's obviously my issue. If I'm angry with them, it's not because they did anything wrong. It's because I've got something to work through. So I did that for a while. You know, I was meditating. I was doing all the things that people say to do. And then one day I hadn't told very many people about what had happened because it was so out there and extreme that I just thought most people would laugh at me. And when I finally opened up to a friend of mine, he said about what was going on, because I'd started to, you know, I'd asked them some questions and sort of it was the early stages of confronting them. My friend said, she's gaslighting you. And I was like, what's that? And he explained it a bit. And I hung up and stopped talking to him. I went home and looked it up online. And as soon as I read the description of what gaslighting was, spiritual gaslighting, really, the light bulb went on, and I, all of a sudden I could see what these people were doing. And they'd be doing it for, you know, for months. And somewhere around that, I found a lady, Irene Lai, and she was teaching how to work with the nervous system, how to work with, her whole way of doing is, you know, working with trauma, working with the nervous system, cleaning it up, rewiring it. Found some stuff from her because my sister had just gotten into she just started working with a somatic therapist. So that then led me to Google. Google then led me to Irene. I took one of her courses. And I think within the first week or two, I started to feel two very clear emotions bubbled up, because it was a big part of it is just learning to connect with the body. The two emotions that came up was, one was rage, because I was so furious with these people as I realized what had happened. And absolutely, really just heartbroken, because the girl I was dating at the time, she was working with them too. And I could see that they wormed their way into her head. And by that point, I think I realized that it was probably too late they'd gotten to her so much that it was too late for me to, stop the process from happening. She already thought that there was something. John had trust issues, anger issues, all this. So when I finally started confronting these people and saying, this is wrong, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't be doing this, she just thought I was the idiot, you know, like I was the dark dude, evil dude that they'd made me out to be. So that's where it started.
Yeah, John, I can't help myself. I really want to jump in right now and just reaffirm everything that you're saying here, that what you have shared about this couple serving mushrooms in Thailand, this is like my worst nightmare of psychedelic facilitation. I just want to scream bullshit. This is absolute bullshit what you have just described these people are doing. And this whole fucking channeling with aliens and telling you that your past life, you killed all this. It's just, that is the worst possible application of psychedelics I think I've ever heard of here on the podcast. That is just bullshit. It's terrible. It's awful. No one like that should ever be serving medicine or telling this bullshit to anyone. It's harmful. It's destructive. And it's just, I'm just absolutely horrified at hearing this. And I'm sorry that you had to go through that and that you had to have others projecting onto you that was all your problem and the gaslighting that comes with it. And, you know, it's usually said with a loving, like, oh, I really want you to overcome this darkness and really confront these aspects of yourself because I love you so much. So come back for another session and we'll do another channeling and we'll find the right path for you to really heal. And then you too could become an ascended master and you can do some channeling and work with these beings and maybe you can be a light worker as well. Okay, so put on a nice smile and come back into the fold, John. Come back.
It's just, you know what? Like,
oh God, I'm just disgusted.
Yeah. I mean, I laugh now, but it was rough going through it. This is a couple of years ago now. So there's been a lot of work done there, but eventually I ended up cutting them off once I realized what was going on and they weren't willing to talk to me like a human being.
Yeah.
I just cut them off, blocked them everywhere. But 6 months later, I emailed them to be like, look, I want a refund. You guys completely failed to give me what I asked for. And so we had this back and forth of, you know, them trying to, they didn't really defend themselves. They didn't admit to doing anything wrong. They didn't give me a refund, but they did say kind of like what you said, like, oh, maybe we can get on the phone and we can do another healing for you too. You obviously got some stuff that you need to work through.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what happens. Exactly what you said. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that you had to go through that. I mean, on the positive side, it presents you with a very clear picture of this is not the way. This is not the way. So then what is the way? What is actually helpful for people and not just indoctrinating them into some bullshit worldview of super mystical powers, of illusionary projections of your past life and all the rest of that. I mean, oh my God, it rubs me the wrong way. It really, really does, and really encapsulates with some of the worst that takes place in the psychedelic world. So then, let's refocus on the body now. So the more direct route. So in learning about somatic therapy, learning about focusing on the body, how did that start to shift your perspective around all of these things? And especially leaving this couple behind of not taking any responsibility for this, but then in developing a more positive view for yourself.
Well, it really set off a chain of, I mean, it's the reason I'm probably here in Peru, really going back to that. It's the reason where Rachart came from, because the intention for that mushroom ceremony, I had a whole page of stuff I was really hoping to get out of it. But the reason I hired them was I was helping them with some marketing. I've been in marketing for a long time. So they wanted some help getting customers. So I was like, oh, we'll do a trade. You can do some coaching with me and I'll help you write some ads for Facebook. And so one of them wrote this ad that the first line was, get unstuck and on purpose. So that's what brought me in. I read that and I was like, that's how I feel. Like life is pretty good, but like I feel a bit stuck, I guess, on like a fulfillment level. Like on the outside, it's good, but there's something missing. It's kind of like I've had some spiritual things with psychedelics, but yeah, there's just something's not right. Very hard to put my finger on. So I went into the ceremony with them with the intention to, three words, purpose, passion, and profit. Purpose being to find something that I absolutely deeply believed in. Passion that I really enjoyed doing that was just like gave me such a kick. And profit was just some way to make money.
Yeah.
You know, there's a way to put a business model around it so I could make my work or the, you know, find a sense of purpose and passion in the work that I do. And that's really, I didn't realize this until a year or two later. Maybe 2 years later, but it was like that whole thing that happened with them led me into the somatic stuff, learning how to work with the body and the nervous system, which, you know, over, I think it was after a year and a half. So even just a few months in, I'm like, this thing, this somatic stuff, working with the nervous system, it felt like it was all the other stuff, like meditation, power of now, surrender. It's all those things. It's always been about being, learning to be present, learning to be embodied, learning to feel, learning to surrender. But so often I've seen this in friends as well, where someone says, just surrender. And they're like, oh, okay. I surrender. And they say
it. Yeah.
But they don't really get like it's not as simple as just saying I surrender. It's a whole thing. It's very, very simple and yet also not so simple at all. It really takes a lot. And so getting into the whole somatic stuff, I could see that these techniques are doing the same thing. It's still about coming into the body and feeling what's going on there. But it adds these layers and these, I guess, sophistication and nuance that I've never seen before. And so I remember within a few months, I'm like, this should be mainstream. I don't know why this is not widely known everywhere. You've got meditation apps, but there's no apps for this, as far as I know. Certainly no big ones. And so, you know, eventually, I think after a year and a half or something, it's like, man, I have to, you know, I'm just going to do it. You know, I'm not going to wait around. I'm not wait for someone else. I'm just going to start doing it and see what happens. But as far as like how it got there, I mean, we can go into Rachel. I can tell you sort of the story of what happened after that whole thing with these coaches, because that kind of plays into all of it, really.
Sure. And I just wanted to jump on that point that you made about the surrender. And I think it's such an interesting one. So, I mean, this is something that we see a lot with 5-MeO-DMT, where, you know, the advice is always surrender. And, you know, I've seen people, and they're gripping with their bodies and they're like, surrender. They're like actually screaming at themselves, surrender, just surrender, surrender, let go, surrender. And that's obviously, it's the opposite of that. And you can actually see it in the body language. You can see how, okay, the words you're saying are not matching what you're actually doing in your body. And it's such a place of disconnect for so many people. And also what you've mentioned about getting in touch with the emotions. Generally, you know, just generically speaking, women tend to be better at that than men. Certainly I've encountered that a lot of men are very easily accessing their anger, but feeling vulnerable, feeling compassionate, even feeling joy, feeling love, could be very difficult for a lot of men. And that's also something that you can tend to see in their body language and the way that they carry themselves and comport themselves and express themselves. So I think it's such a key window into learning how to be with what is that. Just want to emphasize that I'm definitely in agreement with what you're saying here. So yeah, so we can get into the story of Rage Chart now that I've given my little 2 cents of commentary. Can't help myself.
All good, man. Well, after Thailand and all this shit went down with these coaches, I was in Thailand, moved back to Australia. That was right before the COVID lockdown struck. So I got back to Australia a week or two later. Australia closed its borders. I was just meant to be there for a few weeks with family and then a road trip. But the COVID stuff knocked that out. So I ended up spending 2 months at mom's and then went to dad's. And while I was at dad's, so doing this work with like Rage Chart, so I've meditated for 10 years up until that point, almost daily. So I could sit there. I could, you know, sometimes 2 to 4 hours, like I could do it. I could, you know, especially for hours too. But what it didn't teach me was things like boundaries, or I was still ashamed of things like anger or even feeling the anger and then knowing what to do about it. Because once I moved in with dad, because it was COVID was going on, so I'll stay with him for a while. He was into he's into plant medicine as well, actually. It's okay to share that around here. So we do, you know, we'd explore it together, but there was things that would happen and things that he would do or say I just really didn't like. And in the past, when I was younger, I would have just been like, oh, like I won't say anything, keep the peace, people pleasing, kind of a thing. Whereas now after the whole thing with the coaches, I'd gradually be coming to realize that if I'm upset about something with someone, like something that someone else is doing, I need to tell them. Yeah. And if I don't tell them, it's not my fault. It's not their fault if they keep doing it. Like I need to share and be vulnerable in that way and give them a chance to, they can say yes or no, but at the very least I need to tell them, hey, when you do this thing, I really don't like it. And here's why. Can you please stop doing it? So there's a few things like that with my dad. It doesn't even really matter what they are. They're not huge things, but it was enough that it's like, look, I don't want you to talk about that around me. You do whatever you want to do. Like it's your life. Just don't talk to me about that.
Yeah.
He really struggled with that. And over time I could see that in a much smaller way to what these coaches did, but in a smaller but similar kind of vibe was the gaslighting and the guilt tripping and the manipulation and this, you know, don't be such a, it's not that big of a deal. You know, this is minimization or guilt tripping. Anytime I'd make a, you know, point out something that maybe I wasn't happy with, it would be, oh, I've done so much for you. Can't you just be happy? Kind of thing. So this constant invalidation of what I'm feeling. And so of course I start, you know, I was reflecting, I'm, you know, drinking, working with the plants at that time as well. So while doing the somatic stuff and coming to realize that this is a lot of how I grew up, I think with him was a lot of that stuff was going on, very subtle. Especially for a child, very hard to notice and see what's wrong with it. But I think a child in that situation, I know how it worked for me was if I wanted to share something with, say, my dad, and then I would be shamed or made to feel that in some way that something's wrong with me for having that feeling. The way the system works is I want to maintain unconsciously the attachment relationship with my dad. So I'll choose the attachment over love or authenticity. I'll choose love over authenticity.
Right.
So over time, I come to go, well, something's wrong with me. Maybe I am a bad person. So then, of course, that's what these coaches were playing on. And they didn't create that. It was already in me. I eventually started to realize in me from my own childhood. And then I could see, okay, these patterns are still going on because I'm staying with dad. And I can see that he's still doing the same stuff. I don't think he's fully aware of it. And I bring it up and bring it up and bring it up. And eventually it culminated. And, you know, he tried, but eventually it just blew up. And that's part of the reason I ended up in Peru. Was because that whole thing with him exploded a bit. But and to the point with the somatic stuff where it's realizing, okay, I've done what I can. I've been honest about what I'm feeling, what I expect, you know, boundaries, all that kind of stuff. And now it's time, it's not working. So now I need to leave and go somewhere else. But it was so interesting to me to see that what happened with these coaches wasn't I think at some point I realized the best way I could put it was that it's almost like I realized that I created this whole situation with these coaches to teach myself a lesson about how I grew up, to force myself to deal with something that I didn't even know that it was there. But I guess it's, you know, talk about the shadow or trauma or, you know, things are sort of hidden away. That brought it right to my face and kind of, I'm thinking, if I don't deal with this, it's going to happen again. Because that opening that these coaches used, it came from my childhood with my family. And if I don't deal with the root of this, which a big part of it was learning to, you know, I was the kind of person who just thought, I never got angry. Just not an angry person.
Right.
Whereas, you know, not the other extreme where you get people who are always angry or that they're explosive. And so for me, a big part of it was learning to honor the anger, not to see it as an enemy or something to push down or avoid, but to see it as a tool or a message for my system to say, you need to talk to this person or there's a boundary that's being crossed or something like that, because it's very protective. There's a lot of other pieces in there, but it was really beautiful once I started to see all that. And, you know, like I said, I've meditated, I've done all the stuff I mentioned, gratitude lists, journaling, breath work, and all of that. It's great. It does have benefits to it, but it all missed this learning how to feel the body and learning how to understand what my emotions are telling me. And so that's why it was like, I need to share this stuff with people, because it's even now, almost over three years into doing it, I've been in plant medicine ceremonies where I'm going through something and I'm like, I don't know how most people would go through something like this without feeling like they're losing their minds if they didn't know about fight and flight and freeze and healthy aggression and all the different energies that can happen and the different things that can happen in the body as the body's processing this stuff. It'd be terrifying. So that's here in the valley. I see that in a scene where most people are probably fairly advanced or fairly well along some of these, you know, personal work journeys, or at least more into it than the average person. So yeah, that's where it comes from, right? It's helped me so much. I've seen it help people in my family, friends, and I just want more people to try it out and experience it and see how amazing it is. So
yeah, well, that's such an excellent personal share and account that you've given here of this developing self-understanding and your relationship to yourself, your emotions, understanding how it's been sort of embedded within your egoic structure coming from your childhood experiences. And one of the things that I wanted to comment on that you mentioned with sort of the people-pleasing and the idea of, you know, this is something that a lot of people suffer from, of the issue of not wanting to make waves, not wanting to make other people feel uncomfortable, not wanting other people to feel challenged. And so there's that tendency to suck it up, to suck it in and to say, okay, well, I'm going to be nice. I'm going to be nice about it. I'm not someone who gets angry. This is something that I went through as a young man. You know, I definitely had my people pleasing and I'm a nice guy and I don't get angry. I don't raise my voice. And that's thankfully something that I've let go of. But this idea that, that is choosing love over authenticity. And this is a place where I like to say, look, love is authenticity. So if you are authentically expressing your anger, that is love. And if you are authentically expressing your attachment and gratitude and desire for connection, that also is love. And so it's kind of this redefining that we've, as humans and as part of society and social interactions, that we've defined love as being nice or as not making other people feel uncomfortable. But that's, for me, that's not actually love. That's just playing into a game of suppression within the self and the disconnection from our authentic energies as they're arising in response to what we're experiencing. And there is room, as you say, for authentic anger. And there's also room for authentic gratitude and all the rest of that. But it's when it becomes a performance that is cutting people off from what they're actually feeling and experiencing. That's where I see it as becoming very dangerous at the personal and social level.
Well, I mean, it's a great point. Like, because I, you know, with my dad, and I've had this with other people in my life too, where, you know, at first, because we learn these childhood programs, right? And it kept me safe, I imagine, as a kid. That's why I did it. It's automatic. Yeah. It's just how the system protects itself. But then as an adult, it's like, what's the most loving thing I can do here? Is it to, you know, toe the line and people please and let people off the hook? Or is it to be really honest with them about what I'm seeing?
Yeah.
And you know, eventually it's like what you're saying. Like, I feel like at some point it's like, I mean, sometimes people don't need the feedback. It's like they're on their own journey. They're going to do it. But sometimes it's like, I need to tell them and they can do whatever they want with it. But the most loving thing I can do is the truth. It's like love and truth. Speak the truth, whatever that is. And because if you don't, if I'm like not talking about that, if I'm not sharing that with someone that I can see something and it's really clear to me, it's almost like I'm not really giving them the opportunity to work through it or deal with it. And even if, you know, so my dad, for example, he doesn't figure it out for 5 years or however long it is, it doesn't really matter. It's like now it's in his court.
Yeah.
Because if I'm hiding that, it's like it's almost like selfish. It's like I'm doing it for me. I'm not really doing it for him, this sort of nice guy thing. It's more about protecting me and making me feel safe and good and comfortable, when really we'll help each other a lot more and we can let this stuff out. You mentioned this at the societal level too. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think it's great that you've made this distinction that as we're developing as children, of course we develop protective mechanisms to take care of ourselves through whatever our experiences are. And, you know, some people have more traumatic childhoods than others, and others say, oh, my childhood was fine. But we still develop these systems in which we box ourselves in, right? And we do it for protective purposes. But part of becoming a mature adult is then to become aware of, oh, these are the ways I've boxed myself in. This is the way I've put myself in prison, and I've done it to protect myself, but it's not actually serving me. And so that becoming an adult really is becoming self-aware and then taking responsibility for these aspects of ourselves and not just being trapped by our childhood systems. And also not using that as an excuse, like, well, this is the way I was treated as a child, so this is how I am. It's like, well, you're an adult now. You can develop self-awareness and you can take responsibility for yourself, right? So let's talk a little bit more about the distinction between, say, meditation and a somatic approach. And so I would just kind of give sort of a generic description of meditation is the idea of you're calming the mind so that you're observing your thoughts and you might be observing your emotions. But of course, one of the goals in meditation is just be still, don't react, just observe. And so for meditation, you are not invited to, okay, now let out that backlog of sorrow that you've never expressed, or let out that backlog of anger that you've never expressed, or let out that ecstatic joy that you've never expressed. But so there, the difference when we're dealing with somatic therapy, and this is where I think it really applies to psychedelics, is that when we take psychedelics, you feel a lot of stuff going on in your body. You feel a lot of emotions, and there's also a lot of thoughts and insights that might be happening. So there's mental events as well. And then, of course, there's projections, and we can attach to our projections. So meditation serves its purpose. But we're feeling a lot. We're experiencing a lot in the body. And this is where, you know, what I like to see in a psychedelic event is if somebody is experiencing sorrow, I love to see them express that authentically. Or if they're feeling rage, you know, a lot of people feel rage that they don't express. Like one of the things that I've commented on when I was facilitating 5-MeO experiences, that I did have a number of people who, as soon as they would take 5-MeO, they're just like, fuck you, God, I fucking hate you, you bastard. You know, whatever it is, where they're letting out this deep sense of rage and woundedness of, you know, the human condition. And that's the kind of thing that I would just like, oh, awesome, awesome. Let it out, let it out, let it out. And then you've let go of it. And then maybe you can move on to something else. But it's actually having that opportunity to fully embody and express that I see is the most direct route to clearing this stuff out. For me, that's what I think of when I think of like a somatic approach of how are you embodying what you're feeling. And that's why it's so different from meditation. So that's my take on it. How would you like to describe that and your own approach to the somatic side?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of different types of meditation, so that kind of makes it tricky. But yeah. I mean, I meditated for a long time doing, you know, counting my breath. I'd watch the breath. I'd do you know, watching the sensations around my nose. Eventually, it was just being aware. Lots of things like that. And, you know, it was great at sometimes calming the mind. So I'd lose a lot of thoughts. The thoughts would get a bit, you know, get a bit emptier or quieter. But as soon as I got up to go and do things and live my life, it'd be back to normal. It wouldn't last. It wasn't embodied, I guess you could say. It was limited to a fairly narrow, you know, space or set of, you know, situation. Then I found the somatic stuff. And one of the first things I learned was to feel the ground while seeing with my eyes open and noticing the breath. The three things, weave them into one point of awareness. It all started with that. And as soon as I did that, it was just this sense of embodiment. I don't know what else to call it. It was so different from what I get with meditation, when I'm sitting down with my eyes shut. Just this sense of, we need a better word for it. I think embodiment is a bit clunky, but there's a very specific sense when I'm here, I'm landed. And sometimes I'll even feel it. It's like the sensation of settling. Instead of everything's concentrated around my head, I feel it's like all of a sudden, whatever I am seems to start to take up all the space in my body. So that's where it started. And that's when, shortly after that, was when that anger and that grief came up. And it was really just from meditating, because I've been meditating for ages before that. And the grief, the anger, I didn't even touch it. And then, but by feeling the ground and seeing eyes open, there's something really powerful about keeping the eyes open, which is why I rarely meditate now. And if I'm doing like internal body scans, I'm usually doing it with my eyes open. There's something about pairing the external with the internal that creates that sense of embodiment. Like I'm really here, it's anchored. Whereas when I've got my eyes shut, I notice there's I don't know if everyone's like this, but I imagine a lot of people are, given our culture is so mental, there's this tendency to sort of space out a little bit. Like I'm here, I'm still there, but I've kind of drifted off into a thought or a thing, or I'm not as present. I might think I am, and I might be quiet. And, one theory for why, you know, some people can get very quiet during meditation is because they're disconnecting from the body, which is where all the messy stuff is, which is where a lot of these thoughts seem to come from. And so it started with that, learning to be in the body, and then everything pops up in its own time. But you're absolutely right. Like a big part of my journey has been like working with aggression, aggression energy. Like I think about anger as, oh, I am really angry with that person. Aggression is, to me, is the energy of it, the sensation that's behind it, the fuel. And, instead of, the way I learned how to do it was, you look at a dog or a cat, when they get angry, they kiss, they growl, they raise their upper lips, or they snarl, you know, their eyes start to narrow as if they're narrowing onto the threat. It's the fight response. Like it's a physiological, expressive, embodied thing. And meditation's approach is usually to just sit with it, just watch it and watch it. Which I've seen how it's worked with me. I just don't think that works that well. Because I've meditated a lot, and I've never really learned how to tap into this aggression, this anger. And then I started doing the somatic stuff. It didn't come up for, I think, until a year, 15 months in. It was after a San Pedro weekend. We had MDMA and San Pedro sort of ceremony, one each day. So there's some insight that came out of that showed me the sometimes my voice not speaking my truth. This is when I was staying with Dad, realizing I'm not saying things that I wanted to say.
Yeah.
So we worked with this thing. The way I worked with the guy that I was working with one-on-one, we sensation in my solar plexus, it's like it's tied up. We do some karate sounds into it, like a ha, to start to break the energy up, and then just track it. So in a way, there's elements of meditation in there where it's okay, put your awareness on the point now and just watch it. But what happens is it starts to move. And as it starts to move, my breath starts to increase, right? Because we're moving from like a relaxed state into sympathetic energy, fight or flight. And so the breathing increases, which is very different to, you know, classic advice would be take a deep breath if you're feeling stressed. But if I took a deep breath at that moment, it shuts the whole charge down. It's like we're very good at keeping the system. We want to keep it as relaxed as possible, when in fact, sometimes we actually want to go into this big energy and we don't want to take a deep breath.
Yeah, that's kind of going back into the whole play nice again. Like, oh, just be nice. You're feeling this energy, but just be nice. Don't make waves. Don't allow the tension to rise up to the surface. Just suppress it, right? So it's more a suppression action with that. Just take a deep breath.
So this is more the opposite. It's like flowing with it. So in this case, I wasn't trying to breathe faster, but it's been tracking it a bit like meditation, I guess you could say, but then letting the breath run free, letting it increase, not trying to control it or slow it down. The sensation moves up. As it gets into the face, it starts to become like a growl, essentially, like a... And it's completely spontaneous. And I'd done some training at that point. It's knew that, okay, what I need to do is embody this. So start raising my upper lip, narrow my eyes, like I'm trying to focus on a threat somewhere. I didn't do it that time, but other times when it's come, I've had a towel. It's like I'm trying to rip the towel. If the towel was someone's neck, it's like trying to break someone's neck with my bare hands kind of thing. So I'm putting that energy into the towel. So the whole idea is, like what you said, is learning to work with this energy. And a lot of times it just wants to find a way out of the body.
Right.
Because it's all stuck. It's sort of there. It was there to drive some kind of behavior at some point. And now it's all jammed up. So now what we want to do is just get it moving and then find a way to have it leave the body, whether by running really fast somewhere or by, you know, if it's fear, sprinting on the spot or trying to rip a towel in half. There's lots of different techniques. But it's all about embodying and expressing the emotion, not just watching it.
Right. And I love that you use the example of a dog or a cat. I always like to use my dog Moxie as an example. But going back to that idea, like if an animal feels threatened, yeah, it will make the pose, it will hiss, it will growl, it will do all of that. And they're fundamentally different than a human being, because human beings usually don't let themselves do that, because they said, no, you got to play nice. Like, this is your problem, so you've got to take care of it. This is just your own trigger, so you know, you got to take responsibility for that and not let yourself feel any of these things. And then if we do actually do that and we let ourselves hiss and growl, then we come back and we're just like, oh, was I a freak, or what are other people going to think of that? And so, like, I use the example of my dog, that when she barks or does something like that, she doesn't come back and say, did I sound too much like a cat when I did that? Or, you know, I wonder what the neighbors really think of me barking. Maybe I should be more quiet. That, no, there's an event happens. There's a stimulus. There's an energy that responds to that. She embodies it. She expresses it, and then she lets it go. And that this is what I always want to see more of within people's psychedelic events, that you're going to experience energies. You need to embody it. You express it, and you let it go. And one of the things I'd like to jump in on here is, so what I experienced when I was going through all of this in myself, because I was experiencing all of these kinds of similar things, and in the context in which I was taking medicines, what people came to me with was, oh, well, you must be working with wolf energy, and then you must be working with serpent energy, and you must be working with bird spirits. And so for me, this is another form of psychedelic gaslighting, this idea of, well, these are actually higher being entities that are now working through your body. And so none of this is really you. These are all these entities that are taking place. And my response was always like, no, this is what I'm experiencing. This is my experience. These are my energies. These are my emotions. But I found so many people tried to steer me away from that and to project into some kind of metaphysical reality. It's just like, no, I'm letting my sorrow out. I'm letting my anger out. I'm letting my fear out, whatever it may be. And I'm embodying it here in this place. So I'm curious, have you also been met with these kinds of interpretations that come in from experts of, oh, well, no, these are the beings and entities you're working with here? Or are you in a place where that somatic nature of, look, I've just got backlogs of energy to release here and embody, is that welcomed? Or I'm just curious what you've experienced around that.
I mean, I haven't had that specific criticism, as far as I can remember. I had some people talking about spider medicine the other day, but I don't think it was in relation to this kind of a thing. I mean, I've had things like the aggression has been a big part of my journey for whatever reason. And, you know, there's been times when we'd come out. It's the kind of thing where you can't force it, right? So I can't just go into it because I choose to go into it. It's more about learning to be more present, and then things happen in their own time. Right. So I'd have the aggression come up, and I, afterwards, usually when it's petering out, because it seems to, the charge comes up. Once it starts, I know what it feels like in the body now. I usually feel my face going, I'll start to yawn. It's pretty clear, like, when it starts to move. And then I'll be, you know, trying to rip things apart and growling, sometimes screaming into a pillow like it's loud. And but then when it starts to peter out, I've had times when I'm just like prowling around my room like a tiger. And I mean, I never thought, oh, I'm channeling a tiger right now. It's more just like, no, it's more like I just want to embody that kind of energy. It's not, it's still me.
Right.
Another time I was on a farm, and it came through, and I was just like beating my chest, and then like sort of bouncing through the grass the way a gorilla might, having the time of my life. It's so like liberating. And the funniest thing is like, it's so animalistic. And the whole point is, the reason we're like this in animal, you know, dogs and cats, like it's a mammalian thing, this fight or flight response. That's why we do it, and animals do it. I lost my train of thought with that, but anyway, I'll finish on that.
No, well, I think that's a great example, because as people do embody these things, that it does come out often with these various animalistic sounds like you're mentioning here. And I think one of the things that's interesting about the human being is that we are not bound by instinct or our biology in the way that, say, a dog or a cat or a gorilla or a tiger is. That, you know, a tiger is pretty much always going to be a tiger. A dog is pretty much always going to be a dog. Gorilla is always going to be a gorilla. But we are much more open-ended, that we have this idea of what it means to be a civilized human being. And so we all try and fit ourselves into that little box. But we actually have the expressive ability where we can mimic and embody the energy of kind of countless other beings. We can make bird sounds, insect sounds, we can growl, we can purr, we can grunt. So we actually have the ability to make these sounds and embody these different sort of energetic configurations so that we're not bound to the socialized human being form. So there's this infinite variety that we can express. And as you say, that as when people really get in touch with that, it's actually a lot of fun. And even though it can be really intense and it might feel like, wow, I'm out of control, but also the point that you made that you can't force it, that's really, I think, one of the keys to the embodiment and expression of authentic energy, that if we're forcing it, then we're trying to do something that's not authentic, but being available for when it arises and then letting ourselves act it out, letting ourselves express it, that's where the real transformative work takes place, because there it's effortless. We're not trying to do it. It's just what's happening. And we're in that state of allowing what is happening without trying, without thinking like, damn, I'm a freak, or, you know, what are the neighbors going to think? That it just, it's this beautiful sense of allowing. And so that's always what I'm trying to help bring out in others, is that sense of allowing and that sense of embodiment. So I really like that description that you've given of prowling around like a tiger or running around like a gorilla, because that's what it looks like sometimes. And it doesn't mean that you are a tiger or you are a gorilla or that you've lost your mind. It's just that's what's arising in this moment, and this is what it looks like when it's embodied and expressed.
All right, that reminds me actually of two things. I don't know if I can remember both of them. The first thing being, like, part of the learning to work with the nervous system and working somatically is there's a practice called following your impulse. So the idea being that a lot of times, and I was very like this, the way we make decisions is very mental. I think about it, make pros and cons list, talk to someone about it. And the point is that on a deeper level, we have this impulse, you can call it intuition, which was always a bit too woo-woo for me. I was like, I get it, but it's a bit hard for me to like grasp what you actually mean. Yeah. Whereas in the nervous system world, someone can start with, okay, well, how do you know when to go to the bathroom? It's not a thought, it's a sensation in your body.
Right.
Right. So hungry. How do you know when you're hungry? You just feel it. You don't think about it. You just feel it for the most part. Some people really do think about it. You feel it. Same as sleep. You sleep when you're tired. It's a sensation. Your eyes get heavy. And so the idea is that we become more attuned to these more obvious like sensations that tell us what we need to do. We can start to hear more subtler impulses. And so that's when it comes to, like you said, the embodiment of a tiger or a gorilla. It's learning to get out of this thinking mind of what should I do, what's the right thing to do, and start to come down into here. And then there's like a wisdom in there that's subtler. It comes through sensations, and there's like just these thoughts that will just flash into your head from nowhere that you didn't think them up. They bang, it's just there. Learning to feel that, and then it's starting to flow with that. And that's why it's like, yeah, the gorilla, the tiger, it's very intuitive, very impulsive, very childlike in a way, getting in touch with that aspect of ourselves. And I mean, there's plenty of people who talk about this. This is not a new concept, but I'd never found someone who could teach it in this such a very grounded, practical way. It blew my mind. And it's, you know, that's where the tiger and the gorilla came from. I didn't go into that. I want to be a gorilla today. It was just like, well, this feels good. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. And I like that you've also described that when we do start to pay attention to these energies and where we might feel blocked or where we might feel sensitive, that the more attention we put on that and the more allowing that takes place, that it tends to move. So you had mentioned like feeling something in your solar plexus and then moving up and then kind of coming into your throat and then coming into your face. And that's also what I like to see, is the movement and the transformation, that just because something feels stuck in one place doesn't mean that you have to put all your attention there, but it is about inviting it to kind of move up and out. And then, as you say, that I like to describe all of these things just as energies. And of course, every energy comes in a form of a wave. And so there's going to be a buildup in intensity, then there's going to be some kind of peak. And then if you allow it, then it washes out. And then that creates a sensation of, as you might say, of grounding or feel anchored or landing, like, okay, I've went through the whole thing and expressed it. And now I can really be here, because I'm no longer agitated by that suppressed energy. So it's been able to clear out and to ground.
Absolutely. And then on the other side of that, this is where it comes back to meditation, I think, because meditation is a way to learn how to not think. But, you know, that's why a lot of people are doing it, to stop thinking so much. And the more I've done this work, I mean, thoughts can create emotions. Absolutely. That sort of goes both ways. But for me, willing to work with the body, if I can clear, like that anger, working with that, clearing that from the body, opening up that space, a lot of thoughts related to anger, it's just gone. Because it's like the fuel, the root of those thoughts was the energy that was kind of stuck or blocked in the body. Once that's released from the system or integrated, you can, different words for what we talk about, where it went, but the thoughts that are connected in with that just kind of dissolve. So it's a way of accomplishing the same goal as meditation, but you don't really even need to, you don't worry about the mind. You don't focus on the mind. You don't try not to think. You just learn to place your awareness on your body in different ways.
Yeah. And, you know, something that just came to mind as you were just sharing that is just thinking about how actually in Western culture, we kind of have 2,500 years of tradition going the other direction. I was just reading an article about Stoicism. I think it was just yesterday, and going back into kind of classical Greek philosophy, you know, where they spend a lot of time talking about the animal passions, and then there is the rational soul. And so the whole aim of Greek philosophy was, how do I suppress the animal passions so that I can more properly reside within the rational soul and not be emotional, not feel? And they also, of course, said the animus is female and feminine, and the psyche is male, and so we want to be male, so we want to promote this idea of the emotionally unaffected rational male versus the out of control female who is constantly pulled by her emotions and her animalistic tendencies. And so we have this built-in sexism, we have built-in anti-body, we have sort of a mind-body dualism taking place, and presenting this idea of what it means to be a true man is someone who is completely rational and stuck in their intellect and cultivating that. And so this whole somatic approach is actually going against 2,500 years of intellectual tradition in the West.
That's a fantastic story. Like, I've done a little bit of Stoicism a long time ago now, but that's a really amazing, because that kind of brings up this feminine masculine polarity, that where we tend to think of, yeah, the male is the mind, or, you know, think and logical and all that, and women are all about their emotions. And the more I've done this, like, it's absolute bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, getting into this nervous system stuff, it's like we all have emotions. We all have a mind. We're all, you know, probably out of balance in different ways. You know, it has nothing to, I don't know. Maybe there is a gender aspect to it. I don't know though.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, that's certainly what I've encountered, is that we're all animals. We are all human beings. We all experience all of these things, and that we all have the same kind of access to it. So I don't, and you know, earlier when I mentioned that, men tend to have greater ease of access to their anger, and women more ease of access to a variety of emotions. I mean, that's just speaking at the sociological level, and because that's how we've been socialized to be. And I don't think that there's anything necessarily inherent in that. You know, it's not like men are naturally unemotional. No, I don't think so. I think men just have learned to channel it into anger and suppression.
It's funny we're talking about this now, because like Ray Charts, so part of the reason I've been in marketing for a long time, so I've been thinking, well, how do I take this thing? It's all about feeling emotions.
Yeah.
And it's traditionally very feminine, or thought of in that way. And, you know, the lady I learned it from, she's fantastic, but most of my friends are not going to go and sign up with her, because she's partly because she's a woman, I think, and also just because of branding and marketing, is it's going to draw in women. It's just that kind of, not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just her style.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, how do we get these? Probably a lot of it's dudes. It'll be women in there as well. How do we open, you know, bring more people in who would never usually get into this because they think it's weak or it's soft or it's girly or something like that, too feminine. And so that's why with Rage Heart, it's like even the name Rage Heart, I'm trying to make this stuff cool, because to me, it's incredible. Like, I get these people, they're into meditation, the journal or something. You guys don't know what you're missing out on, learning how to feel and get in touch with this stuff. It's incredible. So that's what my challenge that I'm trying to figure out is, how do I make this thing like sexy for people who would think usually feeling emotions is a bit too yeah, soft and girly. Yeah. You can't go there. It's a bit gay or something. You know, all this kind of stuff. Get rid of all of that and make it cool. That's my goal. That's why I think on the site right now, it's unleash the beast. The idea, there's a beast inside, right? It's a tiger, the gorilla, something like that. The idea is to tap into this, that this tapping into our feelings is, there's so much power and strength in that. And that's what, you know, anyway, it's a bit of a rant then, but I think it ties in nicely.
Yeah, so a little bit, I think we kind of got off track a little bit, which is totally fine. We've been discussing all kinds of great things, but I think we were going to get into the actual development of Rage Heart and kind of what the program is. So let's go ahead and let's redirect into that. Seems like a good time to talk, like, really. So what have you put together, and what is the format, and how does it all work?
Yeah, well, the way it's all tied together right now is the unleash the beast is what I sort of say to people. Instead of saying feel your emotions or get in touch with your body or this kind of stuff, unleash the beast. The idea being that we are really getting in touch with that animal side, the instinctive, the intuitive, this impulsive side, but in a way that's healthy, it's safe, to integrate it instead of pushing it away, like you said, with you know, the griefs, to bring that in. And we can say we're going to wake it up, we're going to integrate it, whatever, we can say it in different ways. But that's sort of how I'm wrapping it up. That's just the frame. As far as like what the course is and how it works, I mean, it starts with like basic stuff. So feeling the ground, seeing what's orienting to the environment, noticing your breath, starting to blend these things together. That's where it started for me. And then over the course of sort of design, if you did one every day, you'd probably get through it in 3 months. But everyone's going to be different because everyone's coming in with different stuff, different issues, different stages in their journeys. And so it starts, you know, with basic stuff, because the thing with like working with aggression is because it can be so intense. I think it's important to lay these. It's like someone's going to be able to stay in touch with their body before it's like we start going into some really intense things. Otherwise, people can go into intense things and it's feels like a meltdown, or they're, you know, they're off with the fairies somewhere. They're disassociating from what's happening. So it starts off feeling the ground. That becomes part of the every practice. And then I start layering things in. So there's some theory in there about fight and flight, the two sort of survival modes of the nervous system. Then we go into freeze, how that relates to animals, why things get stuck in the nervous system, system and the theory behind it. And then we start layering in a lot of movement practices. So using the body to regulate the mind, which is a really cool thing, where you can, instead of focusing on the mind, if we start to move the body really slowly, while bringing those tools of awareness, like seeing what's around us and feeling the ground, it can slow all the mind down. Really what we're doing is learning to control the fight and flight response. So when we want to come down, we know what to do with the body. Don't even need to worry about the mind. We just know what to do with the body. So it starts to come down and then the mind slows down. And so you're just basically adding, it's like learning to play the guitar. We start with some scales, which is like feeling the ground and seeing what's around. And then the complexity increases over time. And then towards in the last sort of few weeks, then we're getting into aggression and anger, fear, starting to, you know, work on a deeper level.
I was just going to ask, so then is working with the plant medicines, is that incorporated into this, or is this kind of an adjunct to plant medicine work, or how do you see these as fitting together?
Yeah, and that's, I'm still figuring that piece out. I mean, part of it is that there's a legal issue, I suppose. If I go out there saying I'm selling this thing that's going to help you, you know, have better mushroom journeys or something like that, it starts to be a little bit, there's some legal issues there that I need to work out, or there's a certain legal risk that come with doing it that way. So the way I'm doing it right now is there's no mention of psychedelics in the course itself, but like the way I learned it is all someone needs is the techniques. And then I hope that people will take that and then they'll go to their psychedelic journey. So I'll talk about it on podcasts. I'll talk about it in the daily email newsletter that I do, the psychedelic side of things. But it's really, if people have those skills, then it's up to them to go and take it into their, yeah, like a mushroom journey or an ayahuasca ceremony or something like that. It's really, I mean, that's, yeah, I don't really cover the psychedelic part because I feel like the plants kind of do their thing. And all this is really, I see it here. I still do this as well. Like I get in my own way with the plants. I'm thinking too much. The more I'm connected into the body, the smoother everything goes. So I guess the goal with Rage Heart is to give people these tools so that then when they go into their different psychedelic journeys, it's so much easier for them to just relax into it. They're not getting stuck in their mind like so many people do. And then afterwards, as far as the integration goes, this is how I approach it. I'm not really journaling very much. It's very much about just feeling. learning to be very present, feeling what's moving through the body. And as that stuff processes, that's all that really needs to happen, in my experience. Every now and then, there might be something else that's required, but the whole journey seems to be about just more and more and more. It's just pure feeling. The mind, certain tasks, but it's a journey about feeling. And Raychart is really just a set of tools for people to learn how to do that.
Yeah. So setting aside the question of, you know, the legality and how it would work to really integrate all these into one program, I'm just curious if you could kind of give us an idea of what you think a session like that could potentially look like for people. And maybe we can do some comparisons and contrast. So, for example, here in Oregon, we legalized psilocybin-assisted therapy a couple years ago, and now in 2023, people are now at the place where they can open up a facility and have licensed facilitators. And it's all kind of based on the model of, okay, come in, lie down, we're going to put a blanket on you, put some blindfolds on, and two people are going to sit here and watch you for the next 5 hours. Then also here, in Ashland, we have a Santo Daime church. So you can go to the Santo Daime church and drink ayahuasca. And there you're either sitting in meditation or you're dancing and you're singing hymns. And then we also have a lot of ayahuasca ceremonies are held around here. You know, where you're in the dark and you're lying down and you're trying not to disturb your neighbor. And of course we have the Native American church where you go in and you eat peyote and you have to sit cross-legged and then everybody takes turns singing songs. So in other words, a lot of the ways that medicine is worked with in my local area doesn't really make room for any of this kind of somatic stuff, because it would be too disruptive. That's not what we're here for. You're supposed to be quiet. You should be introspecting and thinking, or you should be praying, or you should be singing. You should be engaged in ceremony. But the idea of come and let's take some medicine and then let's really get into your body, or maybe let's go for a hike and let's start paying attention to sounds, smells, textures, the earth, the light, the wind, the air, and then how you might want to embody and express that, right? There's no real room for that in terms of the official channels. So how would you see, how would you orchestrate an event that would invite this level of processing? And also it kind of raises the question of, do you think it's possible to do in groups, or is this best for a one-on-one experience with a facilitator and someone having their somatic process?
Well, I mean, the intention with Raychart is for people to learn the tools, like whether or not someone would drink medicine with me or someone else. If I was going to, you know, sort of set up some kind of curriculum or process for someone to go through, to me, it would be getting someone to go through a course. It doesn't have to be Raychart, but a course like that, where they're learning how to be embodied. They're learning how to feel the ground and see what's around them. They start to work with some survival stress and fight or flight energy outside the medicine space. So they start to get their kind of bearings with embodiment, with feeling. Because I think a lot of people are, without even knowing, they're completely disconnected from that. So starting to build some foundational connection to their body, connection to sensation, some comfort with going into things, coming out of things. So laying in the skills first, kind of like the, I sent an email to my newsletter today, list today about surfing. How it's kind of like you, when you first start surfing, you don't go out in the big waves with a really advanced board straight away. You start on the beach and you sort of practice standing up on the sand. It's really easy. And you kind of get the hang of that first. And then once you kind of figure that out, then you go in the waves, but small waves, you know, it's pretty easy. There's not too many rips. You're not going to die. You know, you sort of work your way up to the big waves, the big surf. And I think an ayahuasca ceremony for some people, I've seen this happen with people in ceremony, they're not ready for it. I mean, I've never seen anyone die or anything, but it just blows them apart in all kinds of different ways. And so it's like layering some of these foundations in place. And then after that, once someone has that, I think they're going to just be so much better at whatever ceremony they end up in, whether it's any of the ones you mentioned, or, you know, if I was going to do something, I don't know exactly how I'd go about it, but I imagine I'd probably try and weave some of these things in, because I think it's easy. Even I do it. I forget about some of these techniques, and I'll be in ceremony. I'll be down some rabbit hole in my mind, having some horrible time usually. And then I'll come back and realize, oh, just feel my heart. And then it's like, oh, I should have been doing this the whole time. Like, how did I forget this? I've been doing this for 2 freaking years and I forget. I'm still like, what? So I think some kind of adding guide, you wouldn't be like constantly guiding people, but just reminding people, you know, occasionally through a ceremony, like, hey, just take a moment to feel the ground. Open your eyes and look at the ceiling or look at the fire. Can you hear the music? What happens if you feel the ground and you hear the music at the same time? Okay, now just notice what your breath is doing. So you could add some of these things in once every hour or something, or once every half hour in a ceremony, to kind of just gradually keep people, or try to cultivate this coming back to the body, coming back to the body, coming back to the body. But I think the real work will be done by people before they go into something like this. It's like learning anything, layering and like getting the skill down first before you up the difficulty with, because plants, my experience so far with plant medicine has been, it's just going to speed it all up. Like, they're fantastic. I love them, but it speeds everything up. Things that will, with this, you know, somatic stuff, things can move. I've purged just like on ayahuasca without any psychedelics at all with somatic stuff. It's got some power behind it. But you start to put like psychedelics with it, it's a lot more powerful. Or even without the somatic stuff, you take meditation, it's just going to open things up so much faster. Just like a big wave coming down the beach, it's going to be a much, much bigger, faster, heavier wave. If you fall off, it's going to throw you around quite a bit, you know? So that's probably how I would approach it.
Yeah. And I think it's such a great addition to the whole process of these somatic elements and really getting in touch with them. And then if we're combining the focus of meditation and the non-attachment of meditation with the awareness of energies in the body and reactivity within the body, and then we're adding in psychedelics, we've got these three prongs, and that's a pretty good foundation to really be developing yourself and become more aware and more authentic. An issue that I kind of wanted to touch on, and I'm just curious what response or views you might have on this. But one of the things that kind of came to mind as you were talking about creating Rage Heart and trying to appeal to men and help them get in touch with these aspects of it. You know, something that we see both in the psychedelic space and in culture in general at this point is kind of the problematization of masculinity. And we have these terms like toxic masculinity and like, well, that's a man who expresses too much anger. And it's become, in some ways, it's become very problematic to be a man, that there was kind of this sense of, oh, men should be more in touch with their emotions so that they're more like women. And then we've had sort of this disconnect in society where women say, oh, the men are too soft. And then, okay, well, then how do I be a stronger, more authentic man, but I don't want to be labeled as toxic, you know, which I think is a really sort of debilitating label to be putting out there. And just even to couple these two things together that say that masculinity is toxic, and also but wanting to make a distinction between what is healthy masculinity versus what might be dysfunctional masculinity. So I'm just curious, have you grappled, pondered, encountered this kind of thinking? How would you respond to that?
I mean, the more I do this work, both with the somatic stuff, I mean, the somatics to me is, it's all about being in the body. There's a cognitive approach. I live with a guy actually who's all about mindfulness. That's his thing. And so we've had some great conversations. It's helped me kind of refine how I think about it, because he's very big on the cognitive side of things. And I'll be like, yeah, but it's all about the body. He's like, yeah, but the somatic stuff, there's cognitive in there, because you're talking about the nervous system and fight and flight. That's a cognitive approach, giving people a mental model to understand what experiences they're having. So there's a cognitive aspect to the somatic stuff, but it's probably 20% of it, 10% of it. Most of it is being in the body, feeling, not thinking about who to be, what to do, what should I do, what is a real man, that kind of a thing. And the same thing has been happening with the plants, where, I mean, I feel like I keep learning this lesson. I drank San Pedro on Saturday, Friday, and I was just seeing yet again, this is not the first time, yet again, that all the books I've read, all the stories I've heard, all the things people have said to me about what I should do, how I should interact with these plants, what I should, just all of it, it all gets in the way of just being me, being who I am, and even just interacting with the plant. All the ideas I have about what it should do, what it's not doing, do I need to help it out? Like, do I need to micromanage it, kind of a thing? Oh, I need to get rid of this spider thing I'm seeing. It all gets in the way. And so now, No, I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about masculinity, or, you know, I've read like Iron John. I've read a bunch of those man books. I don't know what to call them, masculine books. But I don't go there anymore. I tend to just, you know, like I said, follow my impulse. I just tend to, what do I want to do?
Yeah.
I'm just going to do that. And I, you know, I focus on that. And I think, and I tend to think that's probably the answer in a lot of cases for a lot of people. It's getting away from all the ideas about who we're meant to be. Because that's the whole problem. It's like we take one idea, some idea from a kid, let's get rid of that. And we'll just get a new idea from this book I read about who I'm meant to be.
Yeah.
And this is not authenticity. This is living from an idea or putting ourselves in a box, living from a box. And I think the goal, and I'm not nowhere, I mean, I have no idea if there's ever an end point. You're like, okay, I'm done. But I'm a lot further along than I was a few years ago. But to me, that's the path, is really just becoming who we are, which is, in, this can be infuriating, I think, for some people, because they want someone to just tell it to them, or they want to have the idea, this is who I am. Whereas instead, it's this dynamic, ever-shifting, ever-changing, you can't put yourself in a box. The true you, the true one of all of us, cannot be defined. So it's like you can't pin it down. So I don't know. I don't really think about it. We're just like learning to follow that impulse, be intuitive. And a lot of that's just getting all the stuff, all the fight and flight energy, all these emotions in the way that it's, you know, making us behave in certain ways. You get the more of that just disappears or gets purged from the system, the more that authentic self comes through naturally. We don't have to try to be who we are. We just are who we are, the more we get that stuff out of the way.
Yeah. Well, I really love the point that you made about how the dynamism of being your authentic self, that I think sometimes people get locked into the idea of, you know, of spirituality or whatever it may be of, well, as soon as I reach this level, then I will kind of permanently be like this, or I'll permanently be like that, and I will be able to maintain some ideal level of personal perfection or whatever it is. But, you know, when we get into the idea that, look, we are beings of energy, we are emotional, somatic beings in this way, and that actually these things are always shifting, they're always flowing, they're always changing. And so there isn't one thing that I am, because I am what I'm experiencing in any given moment. And that can shift and that can change, and that will respond to whatever environment I'm in. So it actually opens up this kind of radical level of dynamic action and variability, that we're not just putting ourselves into an idealistic box anymore, but we're actually opening up the possibility of, well, I don't know what I'm going to be tomorrow, other than I'm going to continue to be myself as I arrive in that point tomorrow. And, you know, kind of a letting go of both the ambition and the ideal to then open up this space of authentic experience and expression.
Yeah. And a lot of it, like you mentioned perfection, like one time, this is a funny story, when I, from ayahuasca, I was drinking at home once, and I purged, so I got the light off in the room. I'm in my bedroom at home drinking on my own. And you know, I ended up purging, had my bucket. Problem was, it was quite dark. So I start looking, okay, I need a torch. Let's go looking for the torch. While I'm looking for the torch, I happen to tip the bucket onto myself. So the purge goes not only on my clothes, it goes inside my collar and down. And So I put the bucket down, go looking for the torch, knock the bucket over while I'm trying to find the torch. Now it's all over the carpet, and there was a yoga mat there. Finally find the torch, and I'm just staring at it going, oh, what do I do? Like, I mean, I was, you know, still in the ayahuasca space, so I couldn't think straight. And I think I didn't realize it. I was like, oh, I've got to like clean this up right now. Or I was like sort of feeling like, oh, I can't believe I did that. Oh. And at some point it was just like, clean it up tomorrow. It's all good.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Like, you can make mistakes. It's a funny story I can tell one day on a podcast. You know, and the plants has been great at that kind of thing of going, you just like, you get whoever you are is totally imperfect. You're going to make mistakes. It doesn't matter how enlightened or how much stuff you clear. You're going to say the wrong thing and knock buckets of purge over. You know, well, I do that anyway. I don't know if other people do that. And it's really freeing when you get to that point where it's like, I don't have to be who I am right now tomorrow. I can change. I can change everything tomorrow if I really want to. And it's totally fine. I don't need to be consistent all the time. Like, these books say, very, very freeing.
Yeah. So I'm curious, how would you describe, and going through all of this work and going through this whole process, how would you describe, has it impacted your ability to love and accept yourself at greater and deeper levels? Do you feel that that is something that has become easier for yourself as you have moved through all of this kind of processing?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, it's like that whole thing with those coaches, getting to that place where, when I realized one day, I'm like, I think I created this whole thing to teach myself a lesson. It was like, oh, that's magical, like beautiful. So yeah, and then I mean, a big part of it has been learning to listen to the body. So taking breaks when I want to take breaks, sleeping when I want to sleep. I'm not perfect at that. I don't think I need to be. But eating when I want to eat, not eating foods that I don't want to eat, like in all kinds of ways. Like there's the emotional side of, but a lot of it's just getting the mind out of the way. When it's like that, it's like everything's fine. The mind can be saying stuff, but I can just drop in and go look at some trees for 20 minutes, and they're like, everything's pretty good. There might be some pain around, there might be some stuff I've got to deal with, but everything's pretty okay. And just being able to get to that place where it's like I don't need to solve some problem that the mind is going on about just brings in so much peace. And it's, with meditation, the peace almost, there was peace that came with that, but it was almost like a disassociated peace where I wanted to escape into that world, and it was making it harder to do the things and to work and to make money and to interact with people. Whereas now it's like that peace cap comes with me, that joy comes with me wherever I go. It's the motivation to work and, build a business and to just live is it's also integrated now. Whereas with meditation, it was like I had this spiritual side of this peace thing developing and then everything else. Whereas now it's like they're all connected. It's all the same thing now. And a huge piece of that, I mean, a huge part of it has been the plants. Absolutely. The plants have been magical. But a huge part of that for me has been the somatic nervous system stuff too.
Yeah. Well, great. It sounds like it has helped you just land more fully into yourself and into your life to be able to be available for life as it presents itself and not necessarily be attached to the goals or the ideals so that you can be where you are when you're there.
Well, I mean, on that note, like, I mean, there's all kinds of other stuff where it comes in where it's like, it's easier to fall asleep at night because falling asleep, you got to be in like a parasympathetic rest and digest state. So just lie down in bed and do look at various things I know how to do now, and falling asleep is not a problem. Same with food, digesting food. Well, you mentioned ambition and goals, right? That's all still there, but it's different. It's not like I have to get there to be happy. It's more like there's more fire, which I think is where the aggression, because I think as the aggression energy starts becoming unblocked, that energy is the same energy that gets us up to go and do things. So there's more fire now to go and do stuff, build a business and live life than there ever was. But it's all in the context of that authenticity and staying in touch with myself. So yeah, it's magical.
Great. Well, thank you so much for everything that you've shared today. And I've definitely had you on for a while now, and I know that you have something coming up in a little bit. So I think maybe we can wrap up with just kind of talking again about Rage Heart and how people can get involved with that if this sounds inspiring and interesting, and what that would involve for them. And of course, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, that we've got rageheart.co would be the main website. But for people to get involved, what is it involved to get involved?
that's the best place. I don't do social media. I don't, hopefully I'll never have to do it, or I'll just get someone else to do it. So I'm not anywhere on social media. There's just rageheart.co, and you can go there. The best place to start is the daily. It's like a daily email newsletter. So that'll give you a bit more information about it. This might share stories and from my life about how it works and some of the tools and tricks and things like that. And that's the best way. You get a taste. And then if you enjoy that, you can then there's a paid program as well on the back of that that you can get involved with as well. So yeah, rageart.co.
Okay. And I guess I just need to ask you, so what is this about the people-shaped rainbow donuts?
People-shaped rainbow. What do you mean?
Well, it says here on the bio that he's currently based in the mountains of Peru, where he rides his motorbike, trains jujitsu, and eats way too many people-shaped rainbow donuts at his local cafe.
I forgot about that for a second.
Yeah, threw you off,
So,
didn't
well, there, yeah, there's a local
I,
cafe
that's my
elsewhere
gotcha
where.
question for the interview.
It's a local cafe, Alto. They sell, they don't always have these people donuts, but one time they did have these, yeah, people shaped rainbow donuts. So I decided to use that in the bio. And somehow there was a joke with dog sitting right now with her friend Lacey, and she, I can't remember what the joke was, something to do with, I was trying to express my feminine side, so I'm going to eat one of these donuts. And because it's a person, it's like rainbow. It's all about cross-dressing and wearing dresses and lipstick and stuff like that. So that was part of it. I can't really remember how that went down, though. But yeah, so that's an added little tidbit.
All right. Well, great. Well, thanks for your time today, John. We've been speaking with John Wood, a.k.a. the crazy Aussie who doesn't believe in meditation. Rageheart.co. If you want to get in touch with him, go to the website and learn more about connecting with your authentic self through the body and nervous system.
Thanks, mate. Thank you, Martin. It's been great.
All right.